May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dan Velker, of course. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff, Guy Hobbs. Guy Hobbs is currently a citizen of South Africa. He's brought this lawsuit against Elton John, Bernie Taupin, and others for infringement of his original work named Natasha. Natasha is a song, lyrics that he wrote back in 1984 about the emotions experienced by a Western man about a doomed love affair with the love of his life due to the Cold War. This case was dismissed by the district court pursuant to Rule 12b-6 because the district court found that as a matter of law, the allegations, even if true, even if these lyrics were in fact found to have been copied by the defendants, that they were not protectable under the United States copyright laws. The court, however, in this case, we contend, applied the wrong standard. The district court in this case applied a standard that she believed now controls in the Seventh Circuit, and that is that if the individual components of the lyrics of the song, isolated to their most basic components, are themselves not protectable, then there can be no protection of that song whatsoever. We contend that the correct standard, and the standard that perhaps the Peters case truly meant to hold, was that whether or not the individual components or elements of the original composition are protectable or not, that it's the combination of those components, the way in which they're constructed, displayed, and laid out, that can provide copyright protection, notwithstanding that effect.
Even if we were to accept the premise that the district court overread our decision in Peters, the district court opinion does address the elements of the song in combination, and she finds no unique features that have been copied. What is deficient about this alternate holding, wherein she noted that the dissimilarities are as numerous and even more numerous than the similarities?
Good question, Your Honor. First of all, your review of this case is de novo. So, quite frankly, regardless of whether the district court applied the wrong test or not, this court is able, pursuant to its de novo powers, to review this complaint and give the district court's decision no discretion or no weight whatsoever. But in answer to your question more specifically, Your Honor, I think the district court at best gave short shrift to the issue of whether or not the elements of the song, while not protectable individually, can be protectable and should be protectable as they are in combination. The court, in her decision of page 13, made it very clear that it was her belief, the court's belief, that in the Seventh Circuit, it's abundantly clear that if the copied parts are not on their own protectable, that there can be no claim for infringement. And the district court went on to basically say, and I think this is really what you're asking, she says, because the two works do not share any unique features, the issue isn't whether or not the two works share any unique features. That essentially is a reiteration of the rule she just stated. The question is whether the features that are laid out in the lyrics, the creativity in the lyrics, in combination, create a protectable right.
Isn't the issue whether or not the expression of the theme the expression is what is protected? And here we have, it would seem, a very different expressions. Isn't that the bottom line issue?
The court also recognized that there were dissimilarities in the songs, which I think is maybe what you're referring to. The issue in the Seventh Circuit isn't whether there are dissimilarities or not. The issue is whether there are similarities. And I would suggest, Your Honor, that there are enough similarities in this song as laid out in our brief, and these lyrics as laid out in our briefs, that the question of whether or not the ordinary observer would conclude that these songs came from the same source is a question for the prior fact. And this court, I think the Seventh Circuit, has found on occasions that really the issue of whether there are substantial similarities or not is really a question better left for the trier of fact.
But when you compare the lyrics side by side, they seem to be completely different expressions of a very common, theme. Both bear that resemblance to Romeo and Juliet, which through the centuries, has been a theme.
The Supreme Court has found in Feist Publications, which we cite, that the amount of creativity that's necessary to provide copyright protection to a given composition is very minimal, that just some low level of creativity is all that's required. In this case, I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think that you put the two songs side by side, you see the choruses, the hooks in particular, are very much almost identical. A story is told about the same scenario using the same repetition of the women's names, the desire to hold the women, the desire to love the women.
Well, it's not the same scenario. You've got, one couple that actually met and touched and whatever, and another couple where, someone's looking through the fence. They never really meet.
I think that's the key to the fact that in the Seventh Circuit, the dissimilarities are not what's to be focused upon. It's the similarities. The fact that the song was changed, the lyrics were changed by the defendants, doesn't deprive the plaintiff of his right to protection. Otherwise, someone who wanted to infringe could simply take different components of different songs, put them together, and that'd be complete protection.
I hope this isn't an unfair question, but if these song lyrics were so remarkably similar, why did it take more than 15 years for your client to notice the alleged similarities with this incredibly popular song by a well-known artist that's played thousands and thousands of times on the radio?
I really honestly can't answer that question, Your Honor. I just know that my client contends he didn't learn of it until 2001. He was a photojournalist in South Africa. If that played a role in it, I just don't know. I really don't.
There's this, you talk about, I guess, a theme or something, and you say that there's the message, and I share the Drovner skepticism. There's a sharp distinction. You say, well, you shouldn't look at the differences, but when you have the shipboard romance, which is something that is not every day, but it's a common theme that you meet on shipboard romance, and it's really, whatever you want to call it, for a short period of time, and then maybe never again, and say because of certain geographical and philosophical, whatever else, separation. The other one is the imaginary encounter. You see, but you cannot ever connect because of the separation, the wall, and whatever it is, limitation. So it's all imagination and speculation. But those seem to be pretty different, we'll call it messages of whatever. I'm not any music expert, but like everybody else, I sort of grew up with it, and probably one before, well, that's not to say before any of you were born, but I know better than that.
But it's not so much that.
Let me just say,
sure.
It's about an Indian, they called them Indians then, an Indian made from a different tribe, and there was a river separating them, and of course the tribes were fighting or something or other, so there wasn't any way they could get together, and finally they both jumped in the water and drowned or something, but whatever it was the same kind of theme about an unachievable, at least on the one hand, an unachievable romance, and another time and another period. And I just don't think this is such a unique, as you feature. You say, well, they were from different countries and that sort of thing. And you say, don't look at the differences, but that's really what strikes me.
Well, it's not the theme so much that's really, in our view, the relevant inquiry. The relevant inquiry really is the way in which the words are displayed on the way the lyrics appear, where the chorus is set, the way the expression of this man's lost love is laid out, the way her name is repeated, the way the closeness in her name, the fact that he wants to hold her, her eyes, her pale eyes, the fact that he can't send her a letter.
What's the difference in pale eyes and what is was it fire, something on fire?
Well, it's a focus on her eyes.
On fire?
It's a focus on her eyes is the point, Your Honor.
Oh, geez. That's one, it's pretty hard, unless you got your eyes closed, to have any kind of a romantic song that doesn't include that part, I guess. Again, I'm not an artist, you know, so I only hear it when I have to.
I conclude by saying that like as I said, the U.S. Supreme Court has said clearly that the amount of creativity that's necessary to protect a work is very minimal, very, very minimal. And the fact that it's repeated and it's commonly done or felt or experienced, quite frankly, every song you listen to, every romantic song you listen to is repetitive in a lot of different contexts, as we all know. That doesn't mean that somebody can infringe and steal somebody else's work. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Volker. Mr. Ferber?
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, I'm Tom Ferber of Pryor Cashman. We represent the defendants, appellees.
I have a very quick question for
you.
Yes,
Your Honor.
Why didn't you take the very easy and very sure route of claiming the defense of the statute of limitations? Because it seems to have been missed by more than 20 years. I mean, are you affirmatively disclaiming that defense because you prefer that we reach the merits? I mean, what?
This is the reason why, Your Honor.
Okay.
Aside from the fact that there's some case law in this circuit that could make more complicated the question of whether or when the statute really ran, there's a generally accepted proposition, which, again, may or may not be the law of the circuit, but it's certainly not consistently addressed through the various jurisdictions in the United States, that this kind of, if you would call it, a three-year look back. Because if a song is played continuously, even though it may have been composed 20 years ago, the plaintiff could still claim that every time it is put in new albums, performed again, that's again a new infringement, you get a three-year look back. Clearly, had we not won this case on a 12b-6 based on the merits and the absence of actual similarity, there is no question we would have addressed both statute of limitations issues and the now very interestingly developing area of latches, which is, I think, progressed more quickly in the Ninth Circuit than in other circuits, but it is an interesting area. I thought here it was clear that irrespective of when he knew about it, how much it's been performed, if at all, in the last 3 years, we don't have an actionable similarity here. And there, I think, is the key word, Your Honors. I think part of the misunderstanding here on the part of plaintiff is that sometimes the terminology and the jurisprudence of copyright law gets a little confusing, and references to protectability and actionability are confused. So let's be very clear what the defendant's position is in this case and on this appeal. We are not saying that Plaintiff Hobbs's lyrics are not protectable. Of course they are. The question that we presented to the district court and which is on review before this court is whether, when you look at the totality of the expression of the plaintiff's lyrics for the would-be song, there was no music ever composed, Natasha, and Elton John's well-known song, Nikita, there is no actionable, cognizable similarity at the level of copyrightable expression. I think the district court correctly did what has always been done, both before and after Feist, because Feist did not present any sea change in how cases like this are analyzed. It looked at each of the elements, the enumerated elements that plaintiff claimed had been infringed, and saw, wait a second, either these aren't protectable at all, the things that are so hackneyed as to have no meaning, like the repetition of, if a song is about a person and bears that person's name, the repetition of the name in the song, that's a standard device. In a love song or ballad, talking about wanting to hold the object of your affection or needing the object of your affection, as this court said in Peters v. West, it's not about the method of expression, it's about the actual expression. And the actual expression here, taking away the few things that are so clearly sans affaire because they're stock elements, we don't have any substantial similarity of the expression. As Your Honor pointed out, this is, in essence, a type, loosely speaking, of a Romeo and Juliet story, although they're told very differently from different perspectives. And the plaintiff, as you know, had called it a Cold War Romeo and Juliet. In the plaintiff's lyrics, we have a look back, a retrospective of a brief cruise ship romance between a British man and a Ukrainian waitress. And it's about their parting, how she cried at their parting as she sailed away. Nikita's not about an actual romance at all. It's about almost daydreaming, expressing a crush on someone that you view from afar, not on a cruise ship, but behind a wall, so apparently the people have never met. It's about the title character is East German, as the plaintiff's complaint recognizes. It's also, by the way, very telling that the plaintiff's brief is filled with references to certain terms that are rather dangerous to use for a plaintiff in copyright: concepts, themes, and ideas. Concepts and ideas are expressly excluded from protection, of course, under Section 102B of the Copyright Act. And themes, which are as amorphous a concept, fare no better. In Tillman v. New Line Cinema, in which this court affirmed the district court's grant of summary judgment, it was pointed out that the essence of infringement is not in taking a general theme, but the particular expression of the theme. And it's the expression here that I think plaintiff keeps on missing the point on. That's why he talks about concepts of events that never happened. In truth, the only similarity is the use of the word never, hardly proprietary to anybody who writes love songs. Hobbes talks about what they didn't have the chance to do. They never made it to the movies or a dance. She never sent a Valentine. He never got to give her flowers. Elton John's song talks about something completely different. He says Nikita could roll around the globe and never find a warmer soul. Because they don't meet, he'll never get to tell her about his home or get to embrace her. Clearly not problems that the people who had an actual romance on a cruise ship would have faced. They faced different problems. As I said, the repetition of names is as hackneyed a device as there could be. The reference to pale eyes, again, the only similarity is that the word eyes appear. That's hardly protectable. The expression is different. One is about teary eyes because of lovers parting. The other, Elton John sings about seeing from afar that Nikita has eyes that look like ice on fire. Nothing to do with a parting or weeping. And finally, the postal theme, there's no similarity there. He's trying to get double time, double action out of the reference to no Valentine having been sent. Elton John has the rhetorical question about the relationship that never was. Do you ever see the letters I write? And so the district court, of course, reached the proper conclusion. Not only are the individual elements, these ideas that are enumerated by plaintiff, expressed differently each alone, but even when you look at them together, the two works tell completely different stories. They're completely different in content. And Feist doesn't change that. Feist simply says that in certain cases, elements that could never have been regarded as protectable for, like facts, if compiled in a certain way, a very specific selection arrangement, yes, it is possible that it's protectable. From there, you then have to go to the issue of whether it's actionable. In this circuit, we don't have anything close to what's actionable here. We have a good example, not in a literary property case, but in the case of the amusing case of JCW Investments, the two dolls that have the flatulence problem, and what had happened there was, even though the defendant argued that, look, these are just a bunch of unprotectable elements used to make these dolls, the court said, but wait a second, these dolls are barely distinguishable. There's a near identity, which is, of course, exactly the kind of reference to what was required and what the district court in Peters v. West said, which was affirmed by this court. And for that reason, in conclusion, I respectfully submit the plaintiff's claim in this case should suffer exactly the same fate as the plaintiff's claim did in Peters v. West, because the songs are separated by much more than small cosmetic differences. In fact, they really share only very, very small cosmetic similarities. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Ferber. Mr. Volker, your time had expired, but you may have an additional minute if you wish.
I'd like to follow up by saying that I think I'd ask this court before they rule in this case to look side by side at the, we've concluded in our brief, a side by side depiction of the lyrics, and it's color coded. You can look at that, and you can see in particular the substantial similarities in the chorus in particular of these two songs. And I would ask that obviously this court, in order to sustain the district court's finding, has to find that no reasonable jury could possibly conclude that there's been any copying or there's any substantial similarity. I suggest to you that's a question of fact that really in this circuit should be left up in almost all cases to the trier fact. Otherwise, it deprives deprives people of their day in court. And for that reason, we'd ask you to reverse the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Volker. Thank you, Mr. Ferber. The case is taken under advisement. And